Doc Tanner marched with his eyes narrowed to slits and a scarf securely wrapped over his mouth and nose. The cannon fodder contingent to which he had been assigned formed the tail of a 350-yard long column. In front of the human shields were the muties and the leash dogs. Then came the horse and mule-drawn supply carts, the norm fighters, with the cavalry taking the lead. Beside Doc, the elder swineherd Bezoar walked under his own power, limping on a crudely fashioned willow fork crutch. Crad kept a wary eye on his mentor, ready to come to his aid. Like Doc, the others were coated head to foot with beige dirt. Also like him, most had strips of rag tied over their faces. They looked like an army of the disinterred, children between the ages of 7 and 13, and men and women with healed horrendous wounds and missing limbs. Some of the fodder resembled the young swineherd. In Deathlands, evocative parlance, triple-stoop droolies. So far, all those who had tried to escape from Malasha's army had failed. Even if successful escape had been possible, Doc would never have left his battlemates. High above the loose, three-abreast formation, buzzards circle, riding the thermals, waiting for hapless souls to weaken and fall behind. To fall behind was to be abandoned in the desert. And that meant a slow, awful death by heat and dehydration. It meant lying helpless while the carrion birds plucked out your eyes and tongue. The rapid pace of the advance was difficult to maintain, first because of soggy earth, and now because of all the dust the boots, the wheels, and the animals were raising. Talking parched the throat, and the refreshment stops on the march were few and far between. The army trudged down the vast river plain, creeping toward low blue blips on the horizon. As afternoon edged into evening, Malasha's column climbed out of the river valley into the low, rolling desert hills, spotted with clumps of brush. Sunset tinged the mountains to the east, turning the up-tilted layers of folded bedrock into alternating bands of pink and orange. In a notch between the hilltops, they made camp for the night, unharnessing the horses and mules, lighting cooking fires, setting up the tents for the men in charge. Everyone else ate and slept in the open, in groups segregated by function and the relative purity of their genetics. While waiting in line with the rest of the cannon fodder for his supper, Doc saw Jack and Christy standing over by the dog pack. He tried to get their attention, but in the failing light, they didn't see him. Ferdinando, the commander of the human shields, supervised the distribution of their evening meal. His right arm ended in a khaki sock-covered stump just above the elbow. His left hand was badly mangled, as was the right side of his throat and face. A thick brown beard covered his cheeks, everywhere but that angry, waxy patch of scar. Dinner consisted of a single fire-roasted jacket potato and a dipper of water.
This is what the Baron means by plenty to eat.
Fighters march faster on empty stomachs. Dogs are much more eager for the hunt. Don't worry. There'll be feasting enough after we retake Sunspot's bin.
You had control of it and lost it?
Our forces were driven out by Baron Haldane's troops. The battle cost me my arm. Graham went off under a horse I was walking past. Trap tore me up bad, and then the horse fell on top of me. Lost this arm altogether, and it crushed my left hand so I can't fire a blaster no more. Tell the truth, I can hardly pick up a spoon to feed myself.
Malasha's army did that to you?
Oh, no, no. The Grand came from Haldane's men.
But you were a conscript?
Oh, no. A volunteer.
Why in God's name would you do something like that?
Because I come from the heartland of Malasha's Baron. To the west of here, there is nothing but desert. Unfarmable hard scrabble for hundreds of miles in every direction. It's a place so worthless, nobody has ever bothered to try and invade it. Before Malasha took power in the territory, the people in my ville were always just one day away from starvation. We had to watch our children die of hunger and disease. Malasha freed us from our fate. He realized that even though we could never win total victory over the neighboring barons because of our limited numbers, we could raid their territory on a regular basis and send the food back to our people. He forced us into a quick-strike fighting force. We survived by our wits, our courage, and our speed of foot. If we stop moving, we die.
Surely you could pack up and move somewhere else, to greener, more hospitable pastures.
And fall under the boot heel of another baron? Never. The Hardland where we were born has made us who we are, and we are proud of it.
And in the name of that pride, you swear allegiance to the Impaler?
Call him whatever you like. He's a hero to his people.
Perhaps so, but what about the poor souls he has forced to fight and die for him, whose bills he has ransacked?
Wait until you see the effect he has on every person in this army. Malush has no equal in valor or in daring. His example as a warrior raises everyone up.
I've seen how he raises people up. He has no equal in brutality either.
That is a means to an end. 3 die and 50 join us.
You are saying he takes no pleasure from those ghastly public spectacles?
I have fought under Malush for 2 years. Because of that mask he wears, I've never seen him smile. I don't know what gives him pleasure. I only know I will die for him because of what he has done for his people, for my kin.
No matter what he has done to everyone else.
Mark my words. When the time comes, you will die for him too. And gladly.
I will die, but not for the likes of him.
Baron Haldane sat in one of the sunken rear seats of one of Magus's Humvees, with his Remington sawed-off resting across his lap. It was slow going on what was left of the main pre-dark east-west road, old Interstate 10. Haldane reckoned he would have made better time on horseback. The ancient roadbed was split and heaved up in places, and missing altogether in others, which made it impassable for the larger wags. The nimble Humvees scattered out a safe route for the heavier vehicles, sometimes on the highway, sometimes off. The convoy made wide detours around the soft spots, the deep craters and the boulders. Despite all the stoppages and delays, Steel Eyes hadn't showed his face once. The Baron's 3 companions in the Humvee were the lowest form of Deathland's road trash. They stank of rancid body oils, spilled beer, and diesel fuel. The driver wore a pair of yellow-tinted goggles. The other two wore cracked, wraparound dark sunglasses. All 3 sported greasy do-rags.
Driver, how many fighters has Magus got?
Who knows? Got some here, some there, from what I hear. All doing different things for different reasons.
Where's his seat of power?
More like, does he even have one? If you're looking for a stationary target in case things go sour on his deal, you're shit out of luck. Magus' lips are sealed when it comes to stuff like that. Only thing the Magus ever let us grunts in on is our retirement plan.
Yeah, early retirement for coldhards who talk too much.
Or ask too many fucking questions.
Threats taken, the Baron looked out the dusty side window. He hadn't come on the road trip unescorted. He had brought 10 members of the Nuevaville Defense Force with him. Fully armed, they rode in the back of one of the 6x6s. They weren't along just for his personal protection. Before he initiated an all-out chemical attack on Sunspot, he planned to send some of them ahead to warn the garrison stationed there. His troops had to pull back from the ville and be miles away from Ground Zero before the gas assault commenced. Baron Haldane was determined to do everything he could to prevent the killing of his own people. The Baron for life was at a disadvantage in the deal with Magus. He didn't know how to load, aim, or fire the Soviet-made artillery piece. No one else in his barony did either. In point of fact, no one had ever seen a cannon that powerful. According to Magus, it took 8 trained men to operate the gun. So, in exchange for payment, Steel Eyes was to provide the weapon, the chemical warheads, and the expertise to lay the rounds on target. Nuevaville had an ample treasury of precious metals, pre-dark relics, stored food, joy juice, weapons, ammunition, and wag parts, all collected as tolls or in trade for other goods and services. The price Magus had demanded was steep. The precious metal gold was a common currency in many parts of Deathlands. Magus wanted half the gold and a quarter of everything else, but Haldane knew it was worth the cost to end the stalemate. He didn't ask his people to approve spending of their treasure. He didn't have to. No fool, Haldane had refused to part with so much as a grain of wheat until he was satisfied that Magus could do exactly what he claimed, which meant test-firing the blaster on a practice range and seeing the crew in action. Because the plan was to proceed directly to Sunspot from the test site, it also meant that the dark deed would be done, the ville obliterated, before payment actually changed hands. Haldane wasn't surprised that Steel Eyes agreed to those terms. After all, the good Baron had a reputation for honesty and fair dealing, even among the bottom-feeding scabs of the hellscape. The long ride gave Haldane plenty of time to consider the unfathomability of Magus's true motives. The mechanized creature could have had all of the treasure if he'd used the chem shells on Nuevaville. Perhaps he couldn't enter a Poisonville because his troops didn't have chem weapon suits. Perhaps he had no way to decontaminate the spoils. Or maybe the real payoff for him was the monstrous act of mass murder itself, or its anticipated long-term consequences. A more prosperous barony for Haldane meant better pickings for Magus in the future. Steel Eyes always sided with those who had the best chance of turning a profit. Because of the bad road and heavy vehicles, it took the better part of a day to reach the site of the pre-dark Vale of Aquila, the rendezvous point with the blaster team. There wasn't much left of the Vale, a five-acre patch of pocked and cratered asphalt that had been a box store parking lot, concrete foundation pads sprouting rebar and PVC stubble. A rusted-out water tower toppled over on its side, the holding tank split and emptied. Waiting in the middle of the ruined parking lot was another olive-drab 6x6. Hitched to its rear bumper was a long two-wheeled tarp-wrapped trailer. Men jumped out of the cab in rear of the truck. Haldane walked down the row of wags to join his troops. As they stared at the additional potential adversaries, they looked nervous. Nervous men and automatic weapons were a bad combination.
Easy now. Keep your safeties on and your fingers off the triggers. We've got nothing to worry about. Yet. Just watch me and stay alert.
The door to the hulking landship opened. Magus descended to the tarmac and started walking toward the covered trailer. It was horror in motion. The creature lurched forward, swinging its arms, its still human muscles wedded imperfectly to stainless steel bones. Despite the convulsive gait, it glided on buttery smooth, Teflon-coated ball and socket joints. At a wave of his half-metal hand, the blaster crew began unstrapping and uncovering the steely gray D-30 Lyagushka. Cannon revealed, they disconnected the lunette under its muzzle brake from the 6x6's rear bumper hitch. Lowering the blaster's central emplacement jack, they raised the wheels high enough to clear the three trail legs. Then they spread the two outer trails at 120-degree angles on either side.
Where's the practice target?
You can't see it from here with the naked eye. Somebody give him a scope.
A crewman handed the Baron a spotting scope and faced him in the right direction, pointing out the target over his shoulder. It was a skeleton of a shack. More of a utility shed, really, squatting on the desert plain. Once it had been connected to the electric grid, but the power poles leading up to it were all blown down. The heat waves rising off the sand made it difficult to see, even with pre-dark optics.
How far away is it?
8.3 miles.
You're gonna practice with real chem warheads?
Of course not. To lock in the range and the direction and amount of wind drift on the battlefield, the gunners fire a series of smoke rounds. They should be sufficient to convince you that I can do what I say. Crewmen, lock and load.
The eight-man crew loaded a projectile and adjusted the aim. Then they clapped their hands over their ears. Anticipating the blast, Haldane did the same. Magus, on the other hand, simply reached up and turned his off. The Lyagushka jumped on its trails, belching flame and smoke. The 122-millimeter round sailed away. Haldane raised the spotting scope to his eye and reacquired the target. Seconds later, a puff of white smoke erupted downrange. The impact was about 200 yards short of the shack and 100 yards to the left. The crew adjusted for distance and windage and reloaded the gun. This time, the smoke puff was 100 yards too long, but directly in line with the shack. The third shot landed within 30 feet of the ruined shed, pelting it with rock and wreathing it in smoke. The elapsed time from first to last shot was about 4 minutes.
And you can do that to Sunspot.
Oh, Sunspot is much bigger, so it will be even easier to hit. And nobody's going to be shooting back at us from 8 miles away. Did you notice how my crew used the wind drift to make the smoke sweep over the target? They'll do the same thing with the nerve gas.
How many rounds will it take?
Oh, to saturate a villa of that size with CW agent, it'll take a dozen of the binary munitions, give or take a few, depending on the wind's speed and direction.
And once that's done?
Every red-blooded living thing inside the sunspot berm will be dead.
How badly will they suffer?
Oh, charming of you to be so considerate of your intended victims, Baron. If we use the liquid lewisite instead of sarin, their agony would be much prolonged. The blister agent causes immediate burning pain in the chest and eyes, a temporary blindness, and after a latency period of a few hours, causes severe inflammation of the lungs, leading to death. On the other hand, high doses of sarin gas chill relatively quickly, if not painlessly. The nerve agent disrupts the normal functioning of the body's muscles. They go into spasm or cease to operate altogether. Unlike lewisite, its victims, once poisoned, don't move very far. They collapse, go into convulsions, then total paralysis sets in, which causes suffocation. Salting the earth and water around Sunspot with liquid sarin will make it uninhabitable for many years to come. Anyone who comes within a mile of the ruins and takes a deep breath or touches the ground will get a fatal dose. A permanent solution to your quandary is what you wanted. That's what you've got.
Yes, so it would appear.
And you're ready to pay the price?
I'll pay what we agreed on, after the job is done.
Magus stared at him in silence for a long moment. It was difficult for Haldane to say whether what passed over that god-awful mouth of his was a smile, what lips remained to him turned up at the corners as guy wires slipped through Teflon grommets, coiling somewhere under steel skin onto tiny hidden spools.
Just to make sure you don't change your mind after Sunspot falls, I've brought along an inducement.
I won't change my mind.
Nonetheless.
Magus gestured at the landship, steel fingers beckoning impatiently. The side door opened again, and the blonde, dreadlocked henchman stepped out, carrying a beige fiberglass box in both arms. The box was a cube, 2.5 feet wide, deep, and high. At one end was a steel-barred door. The Baron had no experience with pre-dark pet carriers, but he could see there was something good size moving around inside. As the henchman approached, he saw the small, pale fingers clutching at the bars, and behind the locked door, a small, familiar face. Haldane swung his scattergun up in a two-handed grip, bracing himself for sustained rapid fire. It was a standoff, unwinnable by Haldane, and winnable only at great cost to Steel Eyes.
I think we can agree that the boy is in good health. If you want to keep him that way, you and your men should lower your blasters. No way you can chill all of us before we chill him. You need to calm down, Baron. You need to think it through. The child is just a good faith guarantee, a deposit on the full amount. You pay me, and you get your deposit back. You withhold payment, and I will take him apart just to see what makes him tick.
For Christy, the third straight day of march was by far the most difficult. There was an unfamiliar leadenness in her legs. The inside of her head felt like it had been scoured with coarse sand. It wasn't just the starvation rations or the hard terrain, or breathing through a filthy handkerchief, or the distance they had covered. For two nights running, she and Jack had sat back to back with weapons drawn, unable to sleep a wink because of the threat the swampy bastards presented. Even now, every time the muties glanced over their shoulders at her, their faces bruised and battered, she could see it in their eyes. They wanted a chance to even the score. Jack gently nudged her with an elbow, breaking her train of thought. He pointed to the left, to a hilltop to the east. A pair of dark riders had crested the rounded beige summit and were racing down the slope toward the front of the column. Jack pulled his bandana off his face. Somewhere out of sight up ahead, Malosh the Impaler ordered a halt to the advance. The long line of marchers stood in silence while the dust settled and the midday sun beat down on them relentlessly. Though they were stopped, no water barrels were opened, no dippers were passed around. The Baron was hell-bent on conserving as much of the accumulated resources as possible. If he didn't need to drink, nobody drank. The cannon fodder unit was standing behind Jack and Christy. Doc slouched about 30 feet away. Christy watched him peel the long scarf from over his nose and mouth. He didn't shake it out. He wanted it up in his hand while he gasped for air. Under the coating of dust, Doc didn't look at all well. From long experience, Christy knew how to read the signs in his gaunt face and in his body language. If Doc was indeed starting to withdraw into the morass of jumbled memories, of insensate anger, of incalculable loss, there was nothing she or anyone else could do to stop it. She couldn't see past the carts and the backs of the horses to locate Ryan, JB, or Mildred. The six companions were in a unique predicament. Though separated, they all had their weapons and ammo. They weren't bound or hobbled. They were free to move within certain limits, even to regroup if they could manage it quickly enough. But if they regrouped and opened fire with their weapons, they would have been blown apart by 100 blasters. It was very hard to do nothing, to just wait. Above everything else, the companions valued their freedom. They controlled their own destinies, lived by their own code. Christy turned her attention to the ranks of dogs and dog handlers waiting further along ahead of her. The hounds were nearly 3 feet tall at the shoulder, and they looked even taller in comparison to the sawed-off swampies. She guessed the animals weighed somewhere between 150 and 200 pounds. They were lean and well-muscled. From what she'd witnessed over the past 2 days, the relationship between swampies and hounds was pure hate. The dogs had either been captured from wild packs or bred and trained to bring out their savage instincts. Christy caught movement up the line. 2 scouts were riding down the edge of the formation in her direction. Both were tall, skeletally thin black men. One wore a leather ear flap hat lined with sheep fleece. The other had a shaved head and crude metal wristlet strapped to his massive forearms. Their scruffy brown ponies looked too short to carry them. They stopped their mounts in front of Korb.
We spotted a Haldane long-range foot patrol. They're a half mile and a couple of ridges over to the west. Baron says we gotta take them out before they see our dust. We're only about 10 miles from Sunspot now, so he wants as little shooting as we can get away with. He says we gotta use the swampies and the dogs on them. Pick a half a dozen of your other muties as backup.
Without hesitation, Korb turned to Christy and Jack.
I'm taking you two along because you showed me you're not afraid to fight. I don't want any extra trouble. You better keep Snowskin on a short leash. Otherwise, neither one of you will be coming back.
Jack turned his ruby eyes on Korb. Whatever the albino was thinking, whatever he was planning, it was hidden deep beneath those blood-red pools.
You don't have to worry about us. We know how to follow orders.
This way!
The scout waved the muties after him as he turned his horse. The eager hounds dragged their swampy handlers by their neck chains. Christy, Jack, and the other 4 muties ran after them, winding around and through the patches of low scrub. Christy glanced over her shoulder and saw the column hadn't moved. Malosh didn't want to raise any more dust and perhaps give away his position in numbers. When they crested the first hill, the riders were already down the other side and climbing the next rise. It was up and down on a dead run for the next 15 minutes. The horsemen lost them after the third hill, but the chewed-up earth of their tracks was impossible to miss. Christy was amazed that the dogs didn't bark or howl as they followed the trail. It was as if they somehow understood that the tactical situation required stealth. Topping yet another hill, they saw the riders waiting for them in a ravine below.
There has to be water down there. Deep water.
The notch of land between the summits was crowded with stunted green trees and brush. A perfect ambush site. As the dogs and muties ran down to them, the scouts dismounted. The scout pointed to the crest on the other side of the tangle.
They'll be coming along the top of that hill. Take cover in the brush and wait until they pass by.
The scouts opened a gap in the vegetation with machetes. Then they led their horses down into the canopied gully, tying them to bushes. Everyone else followed. It was very dark beneath the dense undergrowth. Along with the others, Christy and Jack crawled on hands and knees to the far side of the gulch.
Korb, Are you going to capture the patrol and make them fight for Milosh?
No. We can't trust them to chill their own. They gotta die. Die real quiet-like.
Minutes passed. Christy lay there, drenched in sweat. The dust trapped under the canopy tickled her nose and made her want to sneeze. A few feet away, unheard, Meconium whispered intently into his hound's torn ear, and as he did so, he was staring daggers at Jack and her. The beast seemed to be taking it all in, its eyes narrowed to slits, its nose, jowls, tongue, and fangs dripping. Then, through the screen of foliage, Christy saw 8 armed men working their way single file along the ridgetop. Every one of them looked warily down into the ravine. None saw the concealed enemy. The hounds could surely smell their quarry scent, but they made no noise. They had stopped breathing. The scouts waited until the patrol had vanished over the crest of the hill. Then they waved the entire force forward, through the curtain of brush and up the slope. They climbed in a ragged skirmish line, as silent as the dead. They topped the hill, then turned loose the dogs. Haldane's men whirled and froze. Before they could bring their weapons to bear, the hounds were in their midst, lunging with bared fangs. Haldane's men fired their pistols, but jostled by the animals, they missed their targets. 2 members of the patrol broke and ran down the hill. In a second, hounds were tearing into them both. The 6 others weighed in with steel-shod rifle butts, and fighting back-to-back, held off the canine onslaught for a minute or two. Then the dogs caught one of them by the leg and dragged him down, and the defensive formation fell apart. The hounds leapt on the backs of the others and sank in their teeth, savagely shaking their heads, pulling the men to the ground by their shoulders, their arms, their necks. The swampies leaned on their clubs, and the scouts held their machetes at port arms, while the pack of beasts did the dirty work. There were many more hounds than victims. Dogs took hold of flailing arms and legs and digging in their paws, pulled against one another. The men caught in the awful tug of war, tried to poke out the eyes of their attackers and clawed at the scarred muzzles in vain.
All right, all right. Pull off the dogs, for Duke's sake. They're going to choke themselves to death.
After they had rechained the dogs, the muties hauled them back from the carnage and tethered them to stakes. The swampies gleefully fell upon the corpses, stripping them of their weapons and valuables. Then they confiscated their enemies' field rations. They left the torn bodies sprawled on the barren hillside for the buzzards. After they recrossed the tangled ravine, the scouts climbed on their horses and rode east. With Korb leading the way, the muties headed back for the main column at a leisurely pace and in no particular order of march. Chained dogs walked in front of and behind Christy and Jack. The animals' appetite for violence was apparently sated. They were no longer dragging their handlers forward. The companion still eyed them warily, and as it turned out, for good reason.
Hey!
Christy and Jack both turned to see Meconium grinning at them. The hound, at the end of the chain leash he held, had its ears pricked up. The dense muscles on its shoulders were bunched into knots, and the short hair along its spine stood up in a bristling ruff.
Oops.
Instead of going for Jack, who was most likely the intended target, for reasons of its own, the animal zeroed in on Christy. She dodged the massive jaws as they snapped shut, then twisted away, pulling her .38 from its holster. Jack drew his revolver too and tried to sight on the beast, but it and Christy were moving too fast, circling, feinting, retreating. He couldn't fire for fear of hitting her, either straight on or with a .357 Magnum round through and through.
Call it off!
My dog's friendly. It won't bite.
Meconium, collect that red blasted thing before someone gets hurt.
The head swampy moved in slow motion to obey. As Christy dodged, the dog snatched hold of the edge of her coat sleeve and with a savage twist of its head, drove her to her knees. Jack darted in, and instead of shooting the animal in the head, brought the butt of his python crashing down on top of its skull. The locked jaws opened, and Christy broke free. Jack took aim, and before he could shoot, the redhead was back in the line of fire. As the animal shook off the blow, she drop-kicked it on the point of the chin, snapping its nose straight up. The hound's eyelids closed, and it flopped onto its chest, teetering from side to side. For a second, it looked like it was going to topple over. Then it recovered and sprang up.
Call it off.
But it likes you. It just wants to be friends.
Christy cocked her 38 and pointed it at the crouching beast.
Call it off, you stumpy bastard.
Call it off yourself, snake hair.
You got it.
As the dog once again launched itself at her, she rammed the muzzle of the Smith & Wesson into its gaping mouth. The other hounds went berserk, their legs driving, dragging their handlers along as they attempted to get at Christy and tear her apart. Christy backed away, gun in hand.
You shouldn't have done that, bitch.
Earlier, Ryan had watched Christy and Jack leave with the dog pack and vanish over the rise.
Can't trust swampies.
Stab their mothers in the back for a line of jolt.
If their mothers don't stab them first, Christy and Jack still have their weapons. They'll lay low and do what they need to do to survive.
We can't do anything to help them under these circumstances anyway.
At the head of the line of troops, Melosh and his captains had dismounted. The officers hunkered down around their baron, looking over his shoulder while he drew diagrams in the dirt with a pointy stick.
I'm gonna do a little recon.
Want some backup?
Nah. This is a solo. Wait here.
The one-eyed man slipped through the milling ranks of the fighters over to where the horses were tethered. While he patted a horse on the rump, he strained to make out what the Baron and his men were so intently discussing. Baron Melosh looked up from the dirt and caught him staring.
Come over here, Mercy. Don't be shy. Join the parley.
Clandestine recon no longer an option, Ryan walked over and stared at the diagram scratched in the dirt.
Sunspot?
That's right.
Our position?
Melosh jabbed the dirt outside the diagram with his stick.
We're about here. There's a 1,000-foot elevation gain between us and the Ville. It sits in a shallow, man-made gorge, blasted out of the bedrock to make way for the road.
In close proximity, in bright sunlight, Ryan could have counted every yellow-headed pimple on Melosh's high forehead. But he didn't. He wondered what was hidden underneath the leather mask that covered nose, mouth, cheeks, and chin. The Baron's four captains stared with rapt attention at their commander. Their respect for his generalship was absolute. And it wasn't based on fear. More like hero worship. The skewering sickened Ryan to the core, but he could see that, like the costume the Baron wore, they were meant to create particular effects. To mystify, to horrify, to awe. Melosh was as much a showman as he was a fighter. The two previous nights, Ryan had kept careful watch on the Baron's tent, looking for any signs of weakness the companions might exploit. There had been no female fighters lined up outside, dragged in one by one and offered up for his sexual pleasure. There had been no drunken revels, no jolt parties. Counter to Melosh's campfire legend, he was neither a serial rapist nor a debaucher. Or maybe he was just saving himself for Sunspot. That was a distinct possibility.
My forces have waged 3 wars against Sunspot Ville in as many years.
I take it you lost.
On the contrary, we won every battle, and we held the Ville for extended periods, only to be eventually driven out by a counterattack from Baron Haldane. His men are in command there now.
If the Ville has been overrun 6 times, there couldn't be much left in the way of spoils to interest you. So Sunspot must have a different kind of value, something that can't be taken away or destroyed by either side. It's a staging point for your attacks deep into Haldane's territory, isn't it?
Good guess, Mercy.
With so much experience, you must know how to retake the place from Haldane.
Even though the terrain is unchanged, what worked once may not work again. There are just 3 possible courses of action. Full frontal assault right up the gut, or an encircling maneuver, followed by infiltration and a coordinated surprise attack, or failing surprise, a prolonged siege. Siege is the least desirable choice because it would reduce Sunspot's stockpile of supplies, which would be useful in our campaign. And a siege would also give Haldane time to send reinforcements. The key elements are the size of the force Haldane has stationed in the Ville and new defenses, if any, since our last visit. That's what will determine the final battle plan.
Sir, shall we send a few of the fighters into the Ville to gather intel on Haldane's garrison?
Fighters would never get back alive. Haldane's men would suspect him at once because of their appearance. No, our spies must be non-threatening. At first or second glance, they must seem nothing but harmless fools. Bring the cannon fodder forward. Let's have a look at it.
After a minute or two, the fighters parted ranks to let the human shields pass. Doc walked within 10 feet of Ryan. Urged forward by a man in a baseball cap carrying a battered 12-gauge pump, Doc smiled a quiet, ready-for-anything smile. Melosh assembled the human sponges, then began sizing up each in turn. He stopped in front of Crad, taking in the odd baby face and stout adult body.
Do you have a name?
Crad merely nodded.
Well?
Well, what?
Do you have a name?
Crad nodded again. From his desperate expression, he didn't understand where the conversation was going, or why. But he did understand that his life depended upon his reply.
Well?
The swineherd drew his head as far back as he could without moving his feet.
He's just flustered, Baron. He gets flustered easy. He's called Crad.
Drooly by any other name. He'll do for this mission.
The Baron looked Bezoar up and down for a second in silence, then moved on to the next man in the row. He stopped before Doc Tanner.
Ah, the pants-wetting geezer.
I assure you, I have no physical or mental condition that would expose me to the humiliation of senile incontinence.
Oh, a well-spoken pants-wetting geezer. You'll counterbalance the tongue-tied young numbskull perfectly.
In what regard, may I ask, sir?
Every idiot must have a loving caretaker. You and the foul-smelling one are going to enter Sunspotville on foot by the main gate. You're going to count the opposition force garrisoned there and return to me with the number. It's a simple assignment. And looking as acting as you do, you shouldn't have any trouble getting past the gate or back out again.
Crad gave Doc a delighted grin.
Go south until you hit Highway 10, then turn east and start up the grade. You can't miss it. Ferdinando, give them a few cold potatoes to take along, and a little jack in case they have to bribe anyone.
Ferdinando hurried off to do Malasha's bidding.
Now, old man, if you're thinking this is your big chance to just walk away from my army, or that you can give our position to the enemy in return for safety or profit, remember, you still have friends on this side. Friends I can hurt in interesting ways. You have until tomorrow at this time to return with the information.
It took the better part of an hour to reach the old interstate. Before Doc and Crad, a low four-lane bridge that had once spanned the wash they were following had fallen to blocks of rubble. The jewel of pre-dark commerce lay in ruin, vast stretches reduced to their component grains of sand. They paralleled the route of the highway, turning east as the Baron had instructed. Tiny yellow and white daisies sprouted along the shaded cracks in the ancient roadbed. A half a pace behind Doc and 3 yards to the right, Crad moved without speaking. He seemed completely unaware of, or unconcerned about, the danger they faced. Doc walked well upwind and maintained a constant distance from his drooly charge. Ahead, a dropped vehicle overpass blocked their path. On the ground in front of the massive pile of cracked concrete and bent rebar were huge, green-painted steel signs. The chem rain and sandblasted grit had nearly erased the words.
Welcome, Center, 3 miles, Sunspot exit.
When they rounded the far side of the overpass, Doc could see the gradual rise of the land in front of them, and in the distance, the old highway ascended and disappeared through a hilltop gorge.
Let's stop for a rest.
The time traveler and the drooly sat on the shoulder of the highway, with their backs to the sun.
Have you ever been to Sunspot?
Never been nowhere.
This is your first adventure away from home?
My first adventure!
You realize you mustn't say a word about Baron Malosh or his army once we're inside the Ville gates. If you do, we'll both be chilled by Haldane's troops.
Crad gave him a blank look.
And if we die in Sunspot, Malosh will chill your friend Bezoar and my friends too, and he will make them suffer first.
The swineherd scratched his smooth chin, his eyes as devoid of understanding as two shiny marbles. Although Crad was an integral part of Doc's cover, it was clear he couldn't count on him for anything else.
Let me do all the talking, then. Don't say anything.
I talk good, but people don't hear me right.
That's why I want you to stay quiet the whole time.
People back in Redbone always made fun of me, just because I get along with pigs. Pigs are my friends.
That's good. Let's move on, shall we?
They resumed the steady, gentle climb. The earmarks of battle were everywhere. A maze of neck-deep fighting trenches had been dug in the sandy soil, scorched here and there by overlapping Gren blasts, surrounded by uncoiled rolls of barbed and razor wire. The long-established attack-and-retreat route was deserted. Near the entrance to the gorge, perched on its rim, Doc saw a crude berm of dirt and eroded concrete. On the highest point of land, overlooking and controlling the floor of the gorge, was Sunspotville. Just beyond the pre-dark turnoff to the Welcome Center, the interstate was gapped and impassable to wags. 100-yard section of the roadway looked as if it had been blown out of the ground with high explosives. The resulting pits and chasms were filled with standing water. The piles of above-ground debris, earth, rock, concrete, rebar, formed an obstacle course that had to be run under the gun sights of the Ville. Doc picked out what looked like three cannon or machine gun emplacements spaced along this side of the berm. Travel through the highway gorge by foot or wag required a detour through Sunspot and out the other side. Wayfarers who wished to proceed had to mount the rutted dirt road leading from the interstate exit to the berm gates above, walking in the crossed fire paths of a pair of hard-sided M60 machine guns. This Doc and Krad did at a measured pace. As they neared the 15-foot-high berm walls, Doc saw that one of the gates was movable. It consisted of a sideways parked tractor trailer that could be hauled aside by a mule team or by human beings. This was the gate for wags and livestock. The gate for foot traffic stood next to it. It was made of an old yellow school bus parked perpendicular to the berm, half buried under rubble, with its front end sticking out. The hood, fenders, and grille of the bus were peppered with bullet holes. The engine block protected the sentries who manned it from blaster fire.
Hold it right there!
A pair of AK-47 sights poked out over the dashboard and through the glassless windshield.
Remember, let me do the talking. Raise your hands in the air. Keep them up in the air until we get to the gate.
What do you want?
We are just simple travelers. Do not shoot. We are coming closer so we don't have to yell.
As Doc and Krad approached the front door of the bus, two Haldane Sec men came out. The men were in their mid-20s, both darkly tanned. One was shirtless and had a narrow, hairless chest. The other was more muscular and wore a sleeveless coyote skin vest, fur side in.
Where did you come from?
Rado territory.
That's a long ways off.
Plenty of hard walking. Not a particularly popular route, either. We haven't seen another living soul for better than 2 weeks.
Any sign of Baron Milosh?
No sign of anybody, as I said.
You and your friend come by yourselves?
Yes, it's just him and me.
You two don't look related.
We're not. He's young and I'm old. I'm smart and he isn't. We make up for each other's failings.
Show us your blasters.
Krad doesn't have a weapon. I can't trust him with one. He's a triple stoop, I'm sorry to say. Given a blaster, he might shoot off his own head.
Doc unholstered his massive Civil War relic and handed it butt first to the guards.
Holy shit! It's got two barrels!
Huh. What do you call that thing?
It's a Lemar. Named after its inventor, Jean-Alexandre François Lemar. As you can see, it's a combination pistol and shotgun. The revolver cylinder rotates around the shotgun barrel.
Was this Lamont a plumber by trade? Was he on Jolt? It isn't even centerfire, is it?
No, it's a percussion weapon.
The first sentry handed the gun to his colleague.
What rad blasted ass dump did you dig this piece of junk out of? Nuke in hell, old man, why don't you get yourself a real blaster?
I assure you that one does the job adequately.
How fast can you reload it? And how many times can you reload it before you have to tear it down and soak all the parts? You should try something that shoots smokeless powder and cased centerfire cartridges.
Maybe he's as dim as his pal.
Maybe he uses the butt end to pound nails.
With your kind permission, we would like to enter the Ville.
Why should we let you in?
We saw evidence of a large scavenger at work below here. There were a number of freshly opened and emptied graves along the highway. We would prefer not to spend the night outside the berm.
Even critters need to eat.
Better you than us, old man.
Doc turned his back on the bus and, out of sight of the guards, dug into the small leather pouch Milosh had given him. He removed two small, crude bits of gold, each probably cut from a melted gob of wedding rings and wristwatches scrounged from some nearby Ground Zero. He handed over the nuggets. The men tested the yellow metal with their teeth and found it to their liking.
All right, you're good to go.
Enjoy your visit.
Coyote Skin moved aside to let them step up into the aisle of the bus. Doc led the way. All the seats had been stripped. The intact side windows were blacked out, their outer surfaces blocked by heaped dirt and rock, but the rear emergency exit of the bus was wide open. Doc hopped down off the back bumper into a flat field lined with semi-trailers and Sealand cargo containers. A pall of greasy wood smoke hung in the air. Tractor wags without doors or wheels and rusting immobile Winnebagos and trailway buses surrounded the only permanent structure, which was the pre-dark welcome center. As with the bus gate in the burn, bullet holes in profusion decorated the sides of every dwelling. Because he had seen similar buildings along other interstates, Doc knew what the welcome center was all about. When the world was still intact, it was a place for tourists to pick up brochures and educate themselves on the state's various attractions and points of interest. In this case, the state was New Mexico. The plate glass windows of the welcome center were gone, replaced with sheets of metal and pieces of scavenged plywood. The curved sidewalk and the double-doored entrance, which had once invited legions of curious travelers, were guarded by two men with assault rifles. The Haldane garrison was housed within, Doc assumed. A gibbet made of pre-dark portable basketball stanchion, complete with empty noose, stood ominously out front. Looking at the surround of hammered earth and the riddled decaying structures, Doc wondered how many times the place had traded occupying armies. Each time, it had lost a little more of its humanity, until it was simply a hilltop junkyard under an unforgiving blue sky. As they advanced, Doc noticed the cultivated fields behind the welcome center. On closer inspection, he saw they were just truck gardens. The crops were far too small to support the number of people milling about in the enclosure. Doc could easily pick the Sekhmen from the rest of Sunspot's inhabitants. They were armed, the Vilfolk weren't. To come up with a four-strength figure for Malash, he was going to have to count weapons. He was up to 11 when a group of unarmed people confronted him. The women outnumbered the men by 3-1. A tall blonde woman stepped forward.
What's your business here, mister?
I have no business as such. I'm just traveling with my friend here. We're looking for a safe place to spend the night.
Your friend could use a wash.
He could use several.
You still have your blaster. You a Haldane man?
Doc admired the resolve in her face, her wide mouth and firm chin. She was truly a handsome woman.
I'm nobody's man. The guards at the gate found my sidearm less than terrifying. That's why they didn't take it from me, I imagine.
Looks like it might blow up in your hand.
Looks can be deceiving.
So they can. Are you harmless?
When called upon to be.
Are you a spy from Malash the Impaler?
I am no one's spy. Why do you persist in questioning my allegiance?
Because you are either with us or you're against us. Either aligned with one of the other barons or with the people of this vill. We've learned there's no difference between our occupiers. One is just as bad as the other.
But surely Malash has a reputation for...
Deserve, no doubt. But he doesn't torture or abuse us. He doesn't dare. When he has control of Sunspot, he depends on our labor, our food, and our water. Whether it's Malash or Haldane in charge, it doesn't matter to us. Both barons rob us, and the Sekhmen of both chill us every time they attack.
Why do you stay here, then?
It's our home. We don't have anywhere else to go. But even if we wanted to leave, we couldn't. Malash and Haldane would never let us. They need us here to farm, to maintain the vill. If we were gone, they'd have to move their own people into the chill zone and risk their lives. Neither baron is willing to do that because their populations are too small to be stretched that far. If we were gone, the armies would have to carry enough supplies to last them through their campaigns. And without long convoys of wags and overstocked storehouses, that just isn't possible.
You are caught in a terrible dilemma.
Our community is slowly dying under the weight of it. When our members get chilled, they can't be replaced. As you can see, most of our menfolk are gone.
It occurred to Doc that no one else had spoken a word. The others had all deferred to this lovely woman. She was the leader.
I have Jack. May I purchase some food and drink and acquire lodgings for the night?
Jack's no good here anymore. We've got nothing left to sell. Water's free. The only thing Nuke Day ever did for us was to open up the sweet springs over behind the Welcome Center. You can't buy food here, but you can come along with us and catch your own dinner if you like.
Much obliged, madam.
Call me Isabel.
I am Theophilus Tanner. Please call me Doc for short. And this is Crad.
Isabel sized up the hulking, odoriferous man. Her evaluation only took a few seconds, but evidently included an IQ test.
If the Dimmy's hungry, bring him along too.
Baron Haldane's kidneys ached, his butt ached, and his neck ached. For the better part of 2.5 days, he had been a pebble trapped inside the constantly shaken tin can that was Magus' Humvee. With the artillery piece in tow, Magus' convoy had virtually crept along. The first day, they covered fewer than 40 miles. This, from 10 hours of running time and 8 hours of breakdowns, backtracking, and retrieving stuck wags from potholes. Once they crossed the pre-dark interstate and headed due south, the going got even slower. To avoid being spotted by Malasha's army, the convoy had made a wide detour to the south of Sunspot. Haldane was on the wrong side of the Humvee to check on their progress. With all the jolting, he couldn't have focused on the horizon, even if he could have seen it. Except for the front windshield, the windows were coated with fine beige dust. One thing was certain. When the convoy could see the Gorge Rim Ville, the Gorge Rim Ville could see them. There was no cover for the big wags among the low hills and broad stretches of flatland. The Baron knew his hilltop garrison would do nothing but watch them creep by. A group of wags as large and well-armed as this one could defend itself against anything but an all-out attack. Because of the distance involved, engaging the convoy would mean leaving Sunspot unprotected for an extended period of time. His men would follow orders, stand their ground, and wait. There was another reason for the detour, as Magus' chief gunner had explained. The prevailing winds swept through the narrow gorge from the west. To prevent the deadly gas from blowing back on the artillery position, a healthy tail or crosswind was absolutely necessary, something a southerly approach provided. By nightfall, if all went well, the weapon would be in firing position, 7 or 8 miles from the target. The sarin gas barrage would commence the next day, after Haldane's garrison had been withdrawn and Malasha's army had reoccupied the ville. Shelling Sunspot with gas, while the masked Baron and his raiders were caught inside its berm, would end the threat from the west for the foreseeable future. Haldane had entered into the deal with deep moral misgivings. To protect his people and their offspring, he had sold his soul to the devil, and in the process, placed his own beloved child in the devil's steel hands. The driver caught his eye and noted his dour expression in the rearview mirror.
Did you really think you could do business with Magus and not come out holding a shitbag? Baron, you are a major disappointment.
What would Magus want with my son? He doesn't need a guarantee of payment other than my given word. Everyone knows I've never robbed a living soul.
Maybe that steelizes his game. You being such a straight-shooting, noble fucking bastard, maybe he just wants to knock you down a peg or two.
You think you're so much better than us, but you're not. You're paying Magus to poison gas an entire ville. Haldane, you're a masked, chilling, cold-hot son of a bitch.
I'm sure he's showing your kid all sorts of interesting things right now. Good old Uncle Steel Eyes and his rolling shop of horrors. Poor kid'll never be writing a noodle again.
If he hurts Thorne, he knows I'll chill him.
Don't think that ain't been tried, Baron. Magus has been shot, stabbed, some big-time heavy shit's been dropped square on top of him, and he's still kicking. One time he even got himself blown up, lost a little meat from the blast, but the metal parts held everything together and he pulled himself right out of the crater. Still got a bit of tranny leak from that one.
Magus ain't afraid of anyone or anything. He does what he wants to whoever he wants.
I once saw him crush a gun barrel with his bare hand. A 7.62mm AK. Mashed the fucker flat. Some folks say he started out in life flesh and blood like you and me. Now he's made himself all nuke-powered and bionic. If you ask me, Steel Eyes never was human. He started out as a machine, not the other way around. White coats put him together before the nuke cost. They all got fried on the big day, but he survived. Over a whole lot of years, he added human bits and pieces to himself because they were easier to come by as spare parts. He's always tinkering with his Haenids, trying to make them work better. He tinkers with the world the same way, ripping stuff out, jamming new stuff in just to see what happens. I swear the Clanker thinks he's God. Who knows? Maybe he is.
Ugliest God you ever saw.
See, it's just like I said. He wasn't born with a regular heart. He don't feel things the way regular people do. He was assembled with a pneumatic pump in his chest. Sounds like a bag of cheap alarm clocks. Deep in his soul, he's a machine. But a real curious one. Baron, you shouldn't have let Magus take your kid.
I didn't let him do anything.
Get your mind around this little fact, Baron. Now that he's got your boy, he's never gonna give it back.
The Baron realized that it was possible the road trash were just jerking his chain again, trying to get a rise out of him, seeing if they could make him fall to pieces. But the louts had opened a gigantic can of worms. Essentially, they were telling him, if he played it straight as he had intended, he was going to get double-crossed. In which case, there was no point in playing it straight. At the edge of Sunspot's truck gardens was a banked wood fire, on top of which the Vilfolk set water-filled cauldrons made from 55-gallon drums. Wreathed in the pungent smoke, women and children stooped between the garden's rows and began carefully harvesting very small piles of new potatoes, greens, carrots, and onions.
Given the quantity of liquid, those are the makings of a rather thin and unsatisfying stew.
We're going to do something about that.
Isabel led Doc, Crad, and a dozen others to the back bumper of the school bus. The eight Vill women were armed with pitchforks or long wooden clubs. The two pairs of men carried empty, lidded sheet steel garbage cans by their handles. They passed through the stripped school bus and out the front door. The sentry grinned.
Good hunting.
I take it that the occupiers don't help with the foraging, Miss Isabel?
The troopers can't leave their posts. Baron Haldane's orders. It's down to us to feed everybody inside the berm.
How come you got no pigs in the Vill?
They're all gone. The last of the hogs went 3 weeks ago.
The invaders appropriated them, I presume?
Nope. And unfortunately, we didn't get to eat them either.
What happened then?
You look like a man of imagination, Doc. A man who enjoys unraveling a mystery.
Yes, I will admit to that.
Well, here's a little mystery for you to play with. Trust me, the answer will be apparent soon enough. In the meantime, feel free to puzzle it out yourself.
When she walked ahead of him down the path to the interstate, Doc found his gaze immediately dropping to take in Isabel's backside. It was the instinctive, hardwired reaction of a human heterosexual male. To Doc's credit, he refrained from openly leering at her charms. He only glanced long enough to appreciate the shapeliness of her bottom, outlined against the well-worn seat of her BDU pants. Tight, muscular, but unmistakably and heart-rendingly feminine. Ever the chivalrous gentleman, Doc Tanner turned his head, forcing himself to stare at the bleak horizon. The woman stirred him in a most pleasant and unusual way. That was undeniable. Not just her mature physical beauty, which was a rare enough thing in a land where tragedy, hardship, and the elements sent men and women reeling into premature old age. Isabel still had her serenity and a vital spark. A bright, wonderful spark. Lost in the warmth of its afterglow, for a few remarkable seconds, Doc was able to forget everything. His past, his mission. In a single file, the ragtag food gatherers descended from the mouth of the gorge onto the shoulder of the ruined highway. After traveling a short distance down the grade, they crossed the interstate and started to trek south, over the arid hills and the barren plain. Doc surveyed the terrain that stretched in front of them. He saw nothing remotely green. It was a moonscape of beige on beige, of sand and sandstone. For many years, Doc and his companions had been on what amounted to a permanent scavenger hunt. Experience was a cruel teacher. In this sort of sunblasted geography, the best that could be hoped for was to stumble onto a nest of muddy rattlesnakes sleeping in a deep, cool rock cairn. Or if there was an oasis hidden somewhere ahead, it might be possible to set up an ambush, waiting for birds or antelope to come to drink.
There appears to be nothing alive here. No plants, no animals, no source of water in this direction.
As you said before, looks can be deceiving. You're only looking at what's on the surface. You've got to look harder, deeper, to see what's really here.
Deeper? I am sorry.
Until a month ago, my people were starving to death. We had been bled dry by successive waves of invaders. Most of us were convinced that the next autumn would be the Vill's last. Then, it came, like manna from heaven, like the sweet spring gushing forth from the rock. And we were saved.
Madam?
A wonderful plan is unfolding before our very eyes, Theo Tanner. You will see it too. I am convinced of that.
Doc started to ask another question, but Isabel reached up and placed her finger gently on his lips.
Wait. It won't be long. It isn't far now.
With Isabel in the lead, they descended into an arroyo and began following its meandering course. Dried stalks of grass, the color of gunpowder, sparsely fringed the gully's rims. The dry stream bed was filled with soft, fine sand. Despite his attraction to her, Doc found himself starting to question the head woman's sanity. Looking on the darkest of dark sides had become a habit, a survival instinct. Then he had a sudden, uncomfortable twinge. It occurred to him that perhaps she and the others were cannies. It occurred to him that he and the swineherd had been taken out of earshot to be slaughtered, then lugged back in quarters that would give body and substance to the evening's pot of stew.
Look.
Across the arroyo, a strip of white rag tied to a stick marked a hole about a yard across in the waist-high bluff.
It appears to be a burrow of some sort. Something quite large, based on the diameter. What's in there?
Dinner on the hoof.
Doc noticed other similar holes spaced at irregular intervals along the length of the low bank. Isabel waved for Doc to follow her.
Be very quiet now, and don't get too close to the hole.
They hunkered down on either side of the opening. Isabel cocked her head, listening at the burrow entrance. Doc listened too, but he could hear nothing. An odd odor emanated from the hole, both fecund and fecal, with a hint of ammonia. Then, in a scrambling rush that sent Doc rocking back on his boot heels, a huge, shiny black creature lunged partway out of the hole. Its horizontal pincer jaws snapped shut, blue-black jaws that could cut a man, or a hog, in two. Doc glimpsed a broad, domed, eyeless head, segmented armored backplates, and thousands of short, bristling yellow legs beneath. As Doc and Isabel jumped out of the way, the creature darted in a blur back inside its hole. Doc pointed his Lamar shotgun barrel at the burrow, prepared to unleash a chamber packed with blue whistlers.
By the three Kennedys! What was that?
A mama skagworm protecting her nest.
That was a skagworm? Good Lord, the ones I've seen were much smaller than that. Perhaps 2 feet long and 4 inches across. And even at that size, they were virtually impossible to dispatch with a blade or blaster.
Those were just the babies. The breeders are like that one, maybe 300 or 400 pounds. She's still carrying her young in her belly. We don't want to mess with her. We're looking for a worm that's just given birth. We've learned the hard way that timing is everything.
The entire crew advanced along the bank as quietly as possible. Isabel and Doc moved from burrow to burrow, listening from a safe distance. At the fourth hole, they hit pay dirt.
We have to wait until the babies finish.
Finish what?
The ultimate gift of a mother worm to her offspring. Their very first meal is her living flesh. And in turn, the baby worms give their flesh to us.
I had no idea they were edible.
The mamas aren't. Their meat tastes like old snow tires.
How do you remove the little ones from the burrow?
We smoke them out.
On her signal, some of the villfolk wrapped oily rags around the ends of sticks, lit them on fire, and tossed them into the den. In seconds, dense gray smoke was billowing from the hole.
We lost some mighty good folks figuring out how to harvest these muties. The trick is to catch them at just the right moment when they pop out of their mama's minky.
Doc aimed his Lama at the center of the gushing smoke.
You won't need that.
The creatures that spilled from the burrow were identical to those he had seen before. Slick armored shells, blue-black bullet heads, rippling rows of crisp insect feet. But they moved much more slowly. Half suffocated by the dense smoke, packed to the gills with their own mother's meat, they slithered sluggishly across the sand. The womenfolk set upon the newborn worms with pitchforks and clubs. Leaning all their weight on the fork handles, they pinned the squirming muties to the ground with the tines. The club-wielding women brought their weapons down on top of the eyeless heads again and again. These weren't love taps. The thick carapaces withstood multiple full-force blows without denting or cracking. But the pea brains inside took a shellacking. After a moment, the worms stopped squirming. Scooping up the stunned creatures on their forks, the women tossed them into the waiting open garbage cans. When the lids closed, the worms regained consciousness. They couldn't bite their way to freedom because their jaws couldn't get a purchase on the curved surface. While this was going on, the burrow's last worm burst through the veil of smoke, made a hard right turn, and ran along the foot of the bank. It seemed much livelier than the others.
Get it! Don't let it get away!
The woman nearest to the worm lunged with her pitchfork. She tried to lead the fleeing creature, but as if sensing the strike, it stopped dead in its tracks. The fork speared deep into the bank, missing the bullet head by inches. Before she could jerk back her weapon, the worm jumped onto the handle and scampered up it. Its jaws snapping like bolt cutters, the two-foot-long mutie attacked. It bit through her trousers and flesh in an instant, then twisted its head into the flesh of her upper thigh, trying to bore up into the warmth of her body cavity. She staggered backward, grabbing the armored shell in both hands. With a supreme effort, she corkscrewed it out of her flesh and flung it away. Bright blood sprayed between her fingers as she desperately clutched the inside of her thigh. Her femoral artery had been severed. The gory skagworm had landed at Doc's feet. Instinctively, he stomped on its head with one boot, then both boots. It was all he could do to keep the thing pinned to the ground. Then help came in the form of a well-aimed pitchfork. The unfortunate victim had bled out in the sand. The Vill folk stood around her still form, staring down ashen-faced and stunned.
Margie knew the risks. It could have been any one of us. We're not going to carry her body all the way back to the Vill. She wouldn't have wanted us to. We'll bury her here.
Using the pitchforks and their bare hands, they dug a shallow grave in the arroyo, then unceremoniously rolled in the limp, still warm corpse. No one said any words over the dead woman before they filled in the hole with sand. Maybe they were all out of goodbyes. The men moved two slabs of heavy rock on top of the earth. Doc thought about mentioning the evidence of a grave-digging critter, but it didn't seem in good taste or politic. Solemnly, and much more warily, they moved down the low bank, repeating the procedure at each likely burrow. Before they had gone 40 yards, the men were straining under the weight of half-full garbage cans. The food gathering was complete.
Good grief! How many of those things are there?
There weren't any until about a month ago. Now there doesn't seem to be an end to them. More and more are moving up from the south every day, and they're damn good eating. Like I said, it's manna from heaven. We don't have to feed them either. When they can't get pigs or prairie dogs, they happily eat each other.
Doesn't that happen when they're piled up inside the containers?
No, they go right to sleep in the dark. The only rub is, they aren't housebroken.